be talking with Beth Heidorn. Beth is the executive director of the Racine Zoo, where all this year they'll be celebrating their 100th birthday. Please join us for that great interview.
Join Marcia and her guests this coming Saturday morning at 11:15.
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Good morning. I'm Guida Brown, one of the program's rotating hosts. My guest today is Dr. James Dimitri Topitsis, PhD, licensed clinical social worker, professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare, and the Director of Clinical Services at the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's here today to talk to us about trauma. Dimitri, thank you for joining me on WGTD's Education Matters.
My pleasure, Guida. Thank you for having me.
All right. So can you give us a quick overview of what trauma is and how you would explain that for a layman?
Sure. You know, originally we learned about this term trauma from war veterans and violent crime victims. And so we generally think about this term, or originally thought about this term, as some kind of event that was very overwhelming, potentially violent in nature, would oftentimes lead to very serious and obvious symptom profiles. But we've come to realize or understand that sometimes trauma, the experience of a traumatic event, is not as dramatic or obvious as, say, war combat or violent crime victimization. And we now believe that there are other subtler, perhaps more ongoing chronic experiences that constitute trauma as well and might lead to serious consequences, but consequences that are also a little bit more subtle and hard to detect. So, for instance, not only is violence exposure traumatic in nature, but perhaps as a child, exposure to substance use in the household or mental health problems in the household or child neglect in the household can be traumatic in nature. Maybe even exposure to poverty can be traumatic in nature. So these more subtle and subtle experiences that are nonetheless overwhelming, particularly for children, and lead to problematic outcomes and distress that, again, might not look like post-traumatic stress disorder, but might look like, for instance, problems interacting with peers, problems regulating one's own emotions, et cetera. So trauma is both an experience, an event, or an experience along with the consequences of that event or experience. And we've come to believe now that what is traumatic might not just be those experiences that are dramatic, but also maybe more subtle in nature. And I hope that that made some sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, can you correlate those for us?
Yeah. So, you know, there were 10 original adverse childhood experiences. A few of them reflected, again, those kind of dramatic, obvious traumas, like, for instance, child sexual abuse and child physical abuse. But then there were additional ACEs, or adverse childhood experience types, that looked more like subtle, overwhelming traumatic experiences, not so much those dramatic, acute traumatic experiences. those would include emotional abuse, neglect, and then exposure to household dysfunction, like, for instance, parental substance use-related challenges, or parental mental health-related challenges, or parent incarceration, etc. So these were 10 experiences, 10 events or experiences that children could be exposed to, and they could be acute one-time experiences, but oftentimes they were ongoing, somewhat recurrent experiences that children endured. And what we found is that these tended to predict long-term negative outcomes for individuals that extended not only into adulthood, but even older adulthood, elder years, for instance, long-term health-related problems, mental health-related problems, behavioral health-related problems, like addiction. These were very, very consequential, according to research that was done in the late 1990s and follow-up research that's been done in the 2000s. And these, what we sort of, what you hear, the themes that emerge from this original adverse childhood experience study, along with second-generation ACE studies, is that these 10 ACEs, along with additional ones, they tend to be more common than we originally thought. They tend to cluster. They tend to, in other words, co-occur. And they tend to lead to very negative outcomes, like life trajectory or life course outcomes for individuals.
So you had been quoted in a series of articles about the amount of trauma in Racine causing an inability for residents to maintain employment, and that was specific with Foxconn's plan to come to the area. And then I also read a recent headline about COVID causing even more trauma for people. Mm-hmm. So what's going on? Are we facing more trauma, or are we just less able to deal with it?
That's a good and complex question, Glida. So I think the answer to, you know, are we facing more trauma is probably a qualified or cautious yes. So by trauma, again, we need that the more subtle kind of expansive version of the term, then I think we are experiencing more trauma. Particularly children are experiencing more traumas. Now, one could argue that, well, is it we're experiencing more traumas, or we're just better able, we're better equipped to identify those experiences? And I would say that's true. We're better able to identify the experiences, and so there might be some inflation of the sort of the understanding of trauma rates just based on our better ability to identify those traumas. That would be number one. But I also would argue that there are some trends in the population to suggest that we might be experiencing greater numbers of trauma over the past couple decades. What might those be? Well, smartphone usage, particularly amongst children, tends to, if it's extensive, tends to impair mental health. And one of the reasons it does that is through bullying. And you could argue that bullying, even online bullying, is a form of trauma. And for a number of children, it very well can be. So I think smartphone usage could potentially increase exposures to trauma, interpersonal traumas amongst young people. We've also had some very good macroeconomic data to suggest that there are the disparities in wealth in our communities are increasing, and we know that when more and more people experience economic hardship, that will increase their children's exposure to adversity, including trauma. So I think economic hardship and disparities of wealth that are growing over the years could potentially increase the rate of trauma exposure amongst children. And then when you think about the pandemic, which introduced psychological uncertainty and economic instability to families, that certainly could have increased the level of trauma exposure amongst families and children. And then the additional stressor of social isolation that was introduced during the pandemic may not itself constitute a trauma, but certainly reduces our ability to combat traumas, because we know that social connection is the number one predictor of resilience to trauma.
Okay, that was a lot to take in.
Yeah, I hope it wasn't too much, but I think the answer to your question, are we experiencing more traumas over the course of the last number of years or even several decades? I think we can hypothesize that potentially the answer is yes.
Right. And so you had indicated that qualified yes, but we also might be better able to identify it. And so if we're identifying it better, it does not appear that we are dealing with it better.
It's a great question. If we're able to identify it better, you would think that, we would be able to ultimately manage it, maybe even resolve it more effectively than we have in the past. And I think that there are competing trends here. I agree with you that if we're able to identify it more readily and more accurately, then aren't we able to address it more effectively? I think the answer is yes. And so I think there have been a number of initiatives or trends that will help us resolve the issue of trauma exposure and maybe even potentially prevent it. So you're, I'm sure, more familiar than I at, with the current movement to introduce mental health specialists into the school systems here in southeastern Wisconsin. That's a very popular sort of initiative or movement here in the Milwaukee area. I think that's a great way to try to sort of address problems that can emerge from trauma exposure in the home, in the community, at school, prior to actually being referred to a mental health specialist in the community, or, God forbid, without even being able to identify trauma exposure. So I think, we're making strides in identifying and addressing trauma exposure earlier and more accurately. There was a movement to introduce ACE screeners within pediatric settings. There's a movement at Children's Hospital here in Milwaukee to co-locate mental health and trauma specialists within pediatric units in order to address kind of a growing concern of mental health disorders or impairments among children. So I think there are lots of different initiatives, trends, programs to suggest that we're aware that trauma and the mental health problems that accompany it are a significant concern for our young people. We're introducing screening and assessment protocols in various contexts, and we're introducing treatment providers in various contexts, including schools and pediatricians' offices. But do these efforts counteract or help us overcome various other trends like the pandemic, like social media usage or overusage amongst young people? I don't know. I think at this point, these are great initiatives, well-informed initiatives. And I hope that over time they will become more widespread and will ultimately have a population level effect. But at this point, I would argue we're sort of in the early phases of these initiatives and of these sort of counteracting movements to try to to try to stem the tide of trauma exposure and trauma effects amongst our young people.
Thank you. Just a reminder, you're listening to Education Matters here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. My name is Guida Brown, and my guest today is Dr. Dimitri Topitsis, and we're discussing trauma. So, Dimitri, looking at what happened in Highland Park on the 4th of July, the parade, how would you counsel people who had to deal with that? What do they expect to go through? How can they get help for themselves? How should other people help them? And how long will that initial reaction to trauma last?
These are all really complex and good questions, Guida. And I suspect that there's not any one definitive answer. I think there are a few themes perhaps to highlight. Number one, people's reaction to trauma exposure, and that is obviously an acute, dramatic, traumatic incident. People's response to it is going to be variable and subjective and individual. And so we want to be pretty careful about predicting how folks are going to respond, that there's going to be a great deal of variation across those who experienced that event firsthand and those who experienced it vicariously through their loved ones, and then the rest of us who experienced it sort of secondhand. So that's number one, variable kind of reaction. And number two, many people will respond to it by virtue of shutting down a little bit, or a lot of it, and of just really kind of isolating or going into a bit of a shell. And if that doesn't last too long, if that doesn't extend over, if they pass a month, 2 weeks to a month, that's a natural and actually probably a self-protective and helpful or okay response, is to sort of just kind of close in on myself and just need to I just need to isolate a little bit or sequester myself a little bit and just kind of protect myself. It's a very natural reaction, and again, if it doesn't extend for a really long period of time, say over 2 to 4 weeks, it's generally okay. Some people are going to really want to reach out, connect with others, talk about it, work through it verbally, and that's also really, really quite healthy. We want to kind of allow for that type of variation. Allow for people to kind of talk through their experience at a relatively great length. These are really, really difficult times, as these types of events now seem to be recurring on a if not daily, weekly basis, and then ongoing events will constitute sort of trauma reminders, trauma triggers. And so I think it's really helpful for us to consider individually and collectively what helps us kind of strengthen ourselves, create a greater sense of stability in the face of what seems to be a quite a difficult time at our civic level, when we're our public life, where we're experiencing a lot of these violent events on a regular basis. So I think we really want to consider, again, collectively and individually, what is stabilizing for us. And this is one of the critical features or factors of trauma recovery, is considering what are those coping skills that really help ground us. Is it taking time for myself? Is it connecting with other people? Is it engaging in some kind of political action or activism that helps me kind of channel my frustration or my energy? Whatever it is, we want to be, I think, listening and practicing those experiences, those coping mechanisms that help us feel healthy, grounded, and can help us sort of weather the storm of events like this. I think we can unfortunately predict that there will be ongoing trauma triggers when we turn on the news or access our news feed. So we really want to be kind of taking good care of ourselves, again, individually and collectively, in the face of our current sort of historical moment.
So I was thinking about sort of that trauma response in connection with social media. Mm-hmm. I remember 2001 when the 9/11, and I remember watching news late into the day and hearing the trauma from the people they were processing on live television, and it was so uncomfortable to me, just so uncomfortable listening to that for them. And now I feel as though with social media, there's so much of that that's happening on a very regular basis. And you talked about secondary trauma, where things happen and we get inundated with those visions or those stories over and over and over, and not necessarily even local.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit more about social media? I know a huge part of that is the bullying on social media and how kids are being affected by that. But the other piece of it, sort of that secondary trauma that we are seeing over and over.
Yeah, so a couple thoughts come to mind, Guida. I mean, number one, you know, when I mentioned that, I think it's, you know, for some people, they're going to really want to reach out and connect with others in order to process through their experience of trauma, manage it, and ground themselves and stabilize themselves. You know, I would really highly recommend that when people do that, they do that in a private setting, or they do that with people that they really trust, they have a great sense of safety with. I mean, on social media, what you often see is when people are processing through their frustration, then that will just trigger frustration on somebody else's part. And so it's not necessarily a quote-unquote therapeutic communication. You
mm-hmm.
have competing, you know, you're competing perspectives kind of elbowing each other out for airspace. That doesn't necessarily, in my estimation or my experience, that doesn't necessarily lead to resolution of one's trauma experience. In order to have that kind of resolution, the expression or the recounting of a traumatic experience is done in a safe, accepting, perhaps even private venue with a trusted other, whether that's a professional or a family member, a close friend, what have you. So I would probably recommend against trying to process one's trauma on social media, one's experience of trauma on social media, and instead seek out more private and safer, perhaps, interpersonal contexts for doing so. That's number one. Number two, you know, social media or media or general media does report relatively dramatic experiences in that are sort of ongoing in our world, whether those are mass shootings, experiences of war, or violent crime. And, you know, I've heard from many people that sometimes taking a media fast can be really helpful if they're feeling relatively sensitive, relatively raw in the aftermath of a trauma exposure. And so, you know, I think titrating one's media experience, social media or otherwise, can be really potentially helpful in the aftermath of trauma exposure, because oftentimes we feel relatively raw after exposures to significant events in our lives. And when we're feeling raw, it's helpful to protect ourselves and to find those intra or interpersonal spaces that can ultimately lead toward a sense of stabilization and healing. And sometimes media, and oftentimes media, is not that venue, is not that space. I would argue that if one is inclined toward a media fast or taking a break toward taking a break from social media or media in general, then perhaps that's a helpful thing to do, particularly if one is feeling a little bit raw in the aftermath of a trauma exposure.
So You mentioned resilience, and that social connection is one of the largest factors of resilience. How do we become resilient people?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, let's think about what predicts resilience. So, number one, what predicts resilience is connection with trusting, safe, and enriching other people. So those who can really support us in difficult times and know us well and accept us as we are. So social connections, really, really important predictor of resilience and, frankly, just well-being. And so it doesn't mean that we have to have a multitude of friends or family connections. It simply means that we have meaningful connections with people in our lives. And so if we're finding ourselves well connected, wonderful. You know, we want to maintain those, enrich those, nurture those, nourish those connections. If we're finding that we're perhaps our social connections aren't as robust, as enriching as we would like them to be, then perhaps we put some attention on that area of our lives. I think that that's not a bad recommendation to necessarily follow. Another interesting and strong predictor of resilience to trauma is what's referred to as an intrinsic locus of control. In other words, my general coping style suggests that I can't necessarily control everything that happens to me, but I certainly can influence my life trajectory by virtue of how I respond to life circumstances and how I try to shape my life circumstances. So trying to develop self-efficacy, areas in my life or outlets in my life where I'm exerting control, whether that's in the workplace and through my personal life, et cetera. So developing coping skills, outlets, that really help me sort of direct my life in an area or toward the direction that I'm that is preferred, that I sort of choose for myself. That's really critical in responding to adversity and trauma. And then last I would argue that having, you know, a relatively robust kind of self-care or wellness plan is really helpful. And it's very much along the lines of developing an intrinsic locus of control and follow-up to that. It's very helpful to generally have kind of a intentional plan by which I'm able to kind of support my own well-being, whatever that means. I have outlets, I have hobbies, I have practices, all of which or some of which really do promote my own well-being. This is really helpful, particularly in life in general, but particularly in the aftermath of trauma exposure. So these, I think, are ways that we can really promote resilience individually. And collectively, the way we promote resilience is, I think, just by deepening our compassion, our care for one another, and our connection to one another.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Education Matters here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. My name is Guida Brown, and my guest today is Dr. Dimitri Topitsis, and we're discussing trauma. So regarding resilience, how do we then help children become resilient?
Yeah. I mean, that's the $64,000 question, and I think number one, you know, we recognize that children thrive and flourish in context. You know, children none of us do, but particularly children do not operate within a vacuum. So the first thing we want to do is we want to assess, you know, their school environment, their family environment, their neighborhood environment, and ensure that those environments are enriching, are supportive, that those environments prevent exposures to significant trauma and toxic stress, for instance. When children are exposed to some forms of adversity, these environments are able to help them overcome those exposures. So what does that mean to have, an enriching school, enriching family life, sort of a supportive neighborhood life? I think there's been a lot of work by a lot of different people to really do a nice job. This work does a really nice job of outlining what sorts of supports, are really helpful. We want a family life that's not, concerned about financial stress on a regular basis. We want a family life where parents have time to interact with children in ways that transcend or extend beyond just sort of the necessary business of the day, but allow for parents to interact with children in ways that are very affectionate and spontaneous and playful. And unfortunately, not in all households is that the case. When families are struggling with poverty, caregivers don't have the time, energy, or attention or space to be able to interact with children in those sort of very playful, affectionate ways. Not always. And that's because they're faced with so much outside stress and adversity. So I think schools, what does it look like for a school to be well-staffed and can address children's needs on the regular? And that can be a trauma-sensitive school. I think these are considerations. And ultimately, what helps children at the individual level maintain a sense of resilience to adversity, even trauma, and that is the pre-existing strong connections with caring adults in their lives, and first and foremost, their caregivers, their parents, and then other adults in their lives, like teachers, coaches, et cetera. So if teachers aren't totally stressed that they can actually pay attention or spend time attending to relationships in the classroom, relationships that they have with their students. I mean, that's really what we want. What we want teachers to be able to do, and that means that we have relatively well-resourced school systems. I would suspect. Again, this is something that I think you know much better than I, Guida. But anything that promotes positive relationships with children, then that's something that ultimately is going to help them either avoid unnecessary traumas or overcome those necessary adversities that they face in their life.
I think that's a really relevant aspect. My ACE score on a good day is a 6, on a bad day it's a 7, and I overcame that, and I fully believe, part of it was my mother, but I think the other part of it was Mr. Smith, my violin teacher. And I talk to people all the time where I say, wow, you're the guy. You're the guy who the kids are looking to for that support, for that resilience, right, to teach them, right, to come into their own. And that's a really scary aspect for a lot of people. I can't be the guy. I'm not qualified to be the guy. And I think we're all sort of qualified to be the guy, right?
Right. It doesn't take anything incredibly special. It just takes attention. There's a famous developmental psychologist at Cornell University. His name is Yuri Bronfenbrenner, and he argued that, what does a child need in order to thrive and flourish? That child just needs some adult to love them dearly, just to be crazy about that kid. So I think really all, we don't need to have special skills in developmental psychology just to, appreciate children, enjoy them, to communicate, even non-verbally, to communicate to them that they're special, that they're great human beings, and that we trust that they will grow into something unique and wonderful, with some shaping, with some support. So I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think that we need incredibly special skills. I think we just need time, attention, frustration, tolerance, maybe even our own sense of well-being to be able to transmit that to children through our connection with them.
How do we then convey that? I mean, it's nice that the schools are adding mental health specialists and doing ACE screenings and, you know, and but that's only if they have the resources. How do we convey you can be the guy?
To other adults.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I think you hit the nail on the head. First and foremost, we have to give folks resources so that, you know, they actually have the time to pay attention to what's really important, first and foremost, what's really foundational, which is relationships. Secondly, you know, just reinforce, I think, what people already know, that, you know, that their connection with young people is critical. It can make the difference. Just think about, just like you said, we think about our own past, you know, our own experiences as children. What really mattered? Well, our loving connections with others. Perhaps disseminating training on trauma-sensitive schooling, trauma-informed care can be helpful for adults in the helping professions in the educational setting. I think trauma-sensitive school movement, I've seen just a scant amount of data to suggest it's promising, but conceptually, theoretically, it looks really great to me. So I think some training in trauma-informed care or trauma-sensitive schooling can be really, really helpful. And I think also, you know, reminding ourselves to take good care of ourselves, reminding ourselves to cultivate our own sense of well-being, our own sense of happiness, so we can transmit that to young people. I think that's critical. That sort of goes without saying. In the mental health profession, we refer to that as vicarious trauma prevention. So we want to make sure that as mental health providers, we have a sense of vitality that we're able to bring to our work every day, a sense of compassion satisfaction or compassion resilience that we're able to bring to our work every day. But I think that's true for all people in, you know, helping professions or educational settings, working with young people. We want to be able to bring a sense of freshness to our work so that we can convey, not just verbally but non-verbally, that we really enjoy what we're doing, and we really enjoy the young people that we're interacting with, whether we're coaches or teachers or teaching assistants or school counselors. I think cultivating our own well-being is critical in order to actually transmit that to young people.
So what happened in Racine specifically when you were quoted, when Foxconn was coming to town, what happened with the community in Racine that we were likely unable to fill those positions?
Well, I had data. It's a good question, Rita. I had data. These weren't my data, but these were data that were available publicly, collected through the Children's Trust Fund in part, to suggest that Racine County's level of exposure to adversity, and particularly childhood adversity, was as high, if not higher, than any other county in the state, and that Foxconn was going to be accessing certain communities for their employee base in Racine County, or potentially so. And there was hope then that, you know, a lot of folks from maybe more socially and economically vulnerable or disadvantaged areas of Racine County would be able to find work in this Foxconn initiative. And what we know is that if someone has experienced, and I've done research in this area, as have many others, what we know is that if someone has experienced significant adversity in their lives, particularly in childhood, and that adversity has gone unaddressed or uncorrected, then just landing a job sometimes or often isn't enough to thrive or succeed at that job. Because that experience of adversity, again, or trauma, again, that has been sort of unaddressed, and that continues to simmer and continues to affect that person's functioning, that experience of trauma could potentially and very well might potentially undermine job performance, undermine one's ability to do well in that job and sustain that job. So just because there was a potential pool of employees that hail from a particular community doesn't necessarily mean that pool of employees will be able to succeed in those jobs. And that was a prediction or a projection based on two sets of data. Number one, we're realizing that Racine County had high levels of ACE exposure. And number two, recognizing that ACE exposure can often undermine health, well-being, and even job performance. So that's what I was kind of putting these different data points together.
Got it. Well, that's fascinating, but it also scares me regarding sort of the great resignation and what we're dealing with now and COVID and everything else you said. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Exactly. I think much brighter minds than I have been very clear that in all likelihood we're facing, a mental health crisis on the order of the public health crisis that we faced with the pandemic. It's based in part on the pandemic and on previous trends prior to that. I mean, our mental health system was already stretched prior to the pandemic, and now it's even stretched further. So, I think there is cause for concern, for sure. And again, it suggests that a job alone isn't necessarily going to solve all one's problems. That sometimes people need more than just a job. They need well-being supports, mental health supports, etc.
So, just to recap, then that would go back to sort of what you were talking about the social connection and the intrinsic locus of control and robust self-care. That's where we really have to focus our efforts in order to get people to overcome their sort of mental health crisis regarding trauma.
I think so. I think in part, not for everybody, but, for a number of people, additional supports, social support, perhaps formal mental health services, self-care activities and practices, for lack of a better term. All of these, I think, all these could be really helpful, and perhaps we could be developing at the collective level a culture and policies that support individual well-being, because this is not just an individual issue. Of course, this is a collective and public issue. How do we develop into a collective that promotes well-being, that promotes resilience to trauma, that prevents trauma in the first place? I mean, I think these are stirring questions, central questions that we're facing as a collective. And many of us have. We have varying answers or competing answers or different takes on this question even. From the field of trauma studies, I think I can safely say that, this is an important question. And I think we have some pretty good general answers to that question, but, how we ultimately implement them at local levels, at individual levels, is going to vary.
Okay. That's about it for our time. I cannot thank you enough, Dimitri, for being here and spending your time talking to us. I want to thank my guest, Dimitri Topitsis, for joining us today for WGTD's Education Matters. I'm Guida Brown.
Thank you very much, Guida. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at wgtd.org.
All this week on WGTD.